Hello, everybody. Thanks for joining us at this session. My name's Rachel Perkins. I'm from the Arrernte and Kalkaroon peoples. But I've also... Oh, thank you very much. But I also have a heritage from Prussian farmers who immigrated to South Australia. And I have a big family here in South Australia as well, on my mother's side. And of course, we've all got a bit of Irish in there somewhere as well. So Irish miners. So yeah, quite an Australian mixed bag, mongrel breed. It's important in these sorts of discussions, particularly on this subject, to acknowledge the people whose country we're on, the Kaurna people. And South Australia is interesting because it was the one colony where there were meant to be treaties negotiated, instructions from Lord Glenelg. And those treaties were never followed in South Australia. And so it's the least we can do as people sitting here in this place to acknowledge the Kaurna people. So on behalf of us all here, we acknowledge them. And can I introduce none other than David Marr? A veteran, is that the appropriate word? A veteran of the festival. Is that okay to say that?
It's true.
Seasoned.
It's true.
And can I just start with a bit of a survey? Who's read his amazing new book? Well, that's good, because it hasn't been out long. When did it come out?
October.
October.
Beautifully timed, 10 days before the voice vote. That was good, wasn't it?
It was good. Can I read, actually, now that you bring it up? I didn't want to start at the end, but let's start at the end because you said it. I just want to read this beautiful part in the book where he says, "The Uluru Statement from the Heart calls not only for a voice in the Constitution, but truth-telling about our history." And he says, "Books can't change the past, but facing the truth together can change the future. Killing for Country went to press as the political struggle over the voice was unresolved. At this uncertain moment, I offer a bloody family saga from the frontier in the hope of us one day reaching the ultimate goal set at Uluru, the coming together after struggle, Makarrara." It was a very poignant end to the book, David, I thought. I mean, I could keep reading. We could just sit up here and read the whole thing. Let's start with this, though. You said that the book was 2 years overdue. How long had you given yourself to write it?
Well, it depends what you mean by it, because yes. The first book I planned to write was going to be focused really solely on my great-great-grandfather and his brother, who were both officers in the native police and both notable killers, one in Queensland and in the Northern Territory on the part of one of them. But as I worked on the book, I became, in my way, more and more interested in the political and economic structures behind both the creation and then, in the face of continual criticism, the survival of a government paramilitary killing force, which operated in Queensland from the first day, a little bit before the first day, until the First World War. In fact, there was one station of the native police that only finally closed down in 1929. And by native police, I mean white officers, Indigenous troopers, killing and clearing from the land Indigenous peoples.
Let's do a quick survey. So who'd heard of who was taught about the native police going to school in Australia? One person, two people, three, four. Excellent.
Younger people.
Younger people?
Yeah.
Mainly? Yeah. So it's quite an unknown slice of our history. I think you beautifully put it, I'm going to quote you a bit today, but you beautifully said... in not knowing about your family's involvement and the story of it in detail, you said, my blindness was so Australian.
I've been writing about the undertow of race in Australian politics almost from the day that I became a journalist in 1974. The first big article I ever wrote was for The Bulletin, where I was then working, and they sent me up to northern Queensland in the aftermath of Whitlam's 1974 campaign, where there had been a very strong backlash against Labor in traditional Labor territory, and I was reporting the racist rage of white voters in Cairns, Mossman and its hinterland at the programs that had been set up by the Whitlam government to assist Indigenous people. They were absolutely furious about it and as a result voted against Labor. That's my first sort of big article. I was proud of it, still quite proud of it. And I wrote about race all the time. And I never thought to look in my own family tree. I never thought to look.
So it's your great... I mean, you go back, actually, two generations before the members of the Native Police Force. You go to Richard Jones, their grandfather.
It's a bit complicated yes. in the way that colonial families can be. But firstly, I do have to say they're not Mars. The Mars are blameless descendants of a venturesome Highland blacksmith who came to Australia and did okay and had a lot of children, grandchildren, great-great-grandchildren, etc. No, this is my mother's family. And what happened was a very wealthy Sydney merchant called Richard Jones, by this time in his mid-30s, back in London to begin buying... Saxon sheep to bring to Australia, which was a great development in the Australian wool industry, decided it was time to get a wife, and for reasons which we can't really tell, found a wife in a very poor street down by the Thames. She was from a very muddled family, and Richard Jones, who was a Christian monster, then actually looked after all of her young brothers and brought them all out to Australia, and their surname was Ewer, U-H-R, and they were they came out one after another when they turned about 12 or 13. He sent a couple of them to King's. He was one of the founders of the King's School. He found perches for them all. And for my great-great-grandfather, he was a lieutenant in the stupendous theft of Aboriginal land for about 30 years.
In Queensland, yeah.
Yeah, New South Wales first and then yes. up into Queensland.
And I wondered about, because obviously the book's quite significant... you could have started it with your great-grandfather, but you went back to Richard Jones and meticulously detailed the establishment of the colony of New South Wales, the establishment of the Legislative Council, you know, the wool industry. I mean, you methodically laid out this epic story that really is the first half of the book.
I hope it's not the first half of the book. I mean, the discovery of my family was, in a way, a godsend because it allowed a spine to be yeah. put into the book, mm. which went from the Legislative Council in the 1820s all the way through to the West Australian goldfields in the 1890s, and they were there all the way. Richard Jones... was the biggest landowner, essentially the biggest landowner in the Legislative Council of New South Wales. I worked very, very closely on this project for nearly 5 years with my partner, Sebastian Tesserero, who's sitting here. And he is he's a lawyer, he's astonishingly methodical, and he's a brilliant searcher, as well as being, I have to say, a rather blunt editor. He is able to detect colonial attitudes in me, which I think are grossly unfair. But what Sebastian was able to do all through the book was search the acreages. And if you want an explanation for the New South Wales Legislative Council, never in the 1820s, 30s or 40s passing a single law for the benefit of the Indigenous people...
Yes.
All you have to know is that from 1829, when Jones joined the council, to 1842, when he left, the land holding of the councillors had risen from 140,000 acres to 1 million. They were dispossessors. The colony was run by dispossessors. Now, all through this, of course, is the beginnings of slaughter and the voices raised against it. And then we get to the killings by the Ewer brothers further down the track.
I'm a filmmaker by trade and I've looked at some of this material, but in a different approach. And what I loved about this book is that it kept that meticulousness of who the people were and what their vested interests were constantly within the reader's mind. And there's just a little passage to illustrate what you've just said here. He's talking about the councillors and he says, the squatter councillors were restless. Sir John Jameson, and then it's got 140,000 acres in brackets after
that's
his name.
We like to do so after each name, you know.
Yeah, and I love that. And then you say, Hannibal MacArthur, 113,000 acres, called for a local inquiry into the Aboriginal question. Gipps agreed. Richard Jones, 183,000 acres, took up a theme he would pursue for the rest of his life, the impractical, expensive, ultra-humane and ignorant thinking of London. So you always knew the way that power was determined in the, you know, against the odds, obviously, for Aboriginal people because of this huge vested interest that the early legislators had.
In land. And also something, I mean, we were all taught a little bit about Australian history when we were at school, talking for my generation. But what wasn't really made clear is the fundamental that the big decisions were all taken in London.
Yes.
And in London, those decisions were heavily heavily affected by the interests of wool brokers, weavers, the Lancashire fabric industry. And as Australia grew richer from wool, and in the 1830s, it was stupendously rich. The influence of those people in London grew even stronger, so that decent-ish, quite decent men governing New South Wales could not get decent outcomes because of the debates going on in London, which they were no part of. And remember time. A governor could write to London asking for a decision and would not get the reply back for a year. And in that year, life just went on. It just went on. And by going on, it meant going further into what were called, appallingly but deliciously, the wasteland of the blacks.
It's monumental in its scope, in the way that it constructs the creation of the modern Australian state, really. Was that your intention when you set out?
Look, this book wouldn't have been possible to write in a way, or it would not, I think, have been possible to engage the sympathies of modern readers unless it was also a history, as it is, of the voices raised continuously saying, this is murder, this must stop, this is theft, this is no way to deal with human beings, against those people like Richard Jones, who, by the way, was the president of the Bank of New South Wales, amongst other things, for about 16 years, the second president of the Bank of New South Wales. Oddly unhonoured. I've been down to headquarters and there's no portrait of him. When he went bankrupt, he also had the largest overdraft at the bank, but that's another story. But all of this is going on in a way that allows this story to be built. And without those voices and those eyes, I think it would have been a morass through which I couldn't move.
Yes.
But it was always my intention of concentrating on the good voices, the bad voices, the economy, the booms, the busts, and the decisions taken in London, which eventually were by some of the best politicians, the same politicians. The Whig politicians, they came back to power in 1830 after being in the wilderness for a long time. Mm-hmm. They did the Great Reform Act, They got rid of the rotten boroughs.
Yes.
They brought the Catholic people back into the political life of the country. They abolished slavery. But at the same time, they would never face down the squatters of New South Wales, ever. And they had a belief that it was God's intention that the wilderness be made productive.
And you see that, don't you, that the governors, you know, another governor comes and they come out with the same orders and then the squatocracy undermines their good intentions, if they had any, and, the law caves in.
But then as you go along, and it kind of wasn't really my intention, but as you go along, you just see modern Australia. There was a huge controversy of which Richard Jones... By the way, this figure, Richard Jones, one of the richest men in the colony, the leader of a number of charities, one of the founders of the King's School, president of the Bank of New South Wales, et cetera, et cetera, there's never been a biography of him. There are a few notes here and there. Manning Clark mentions him, I think, twice. This is the first time this, I think, iconic colonial life has actually been studied. But you look at it and you think, I can recognise modern politics here. And one of the biggest arguments of the time of Governor Burke and thereafter was the right of people in the bush to decide which laws applied to them, and they were not going to be told by Sydney and they were not going to be told by Brisbane. The right to decide. And that's still strong. You know, you tell me I can't clear my land, well, bugger you, I'm clearing my land. That is still very strong. In the politics of this country. And, of course, Queensland was founded in the Queensland way with a fresh gerrymander. When it broke away from New South Wales, every adult male had the vote in Queensland because they did in New South Wales. But Queensland was founded on the notion of taking the vote away from about a third of those men because they weren't wealthy enough in tremendously gerrymandered seats in a parliament dominated by rural interests. So the parliament of then and the parliament of now, the Queensland of then and now, they're perfectly familiar, perfectly familiar. And then when you look at the Voice results, the worst results in the Voice were those areas in Queensland where the worst was done to the Aboriginal people. They're still, you can trace them. They're there. That's where the slaughters happened. That's where the vote was strongest against the Voice. My theory is that the only way we can deal with shame on that scale is to continue to hate. You can't have second thoughts because those second thoughts are so dangerous, so difficult, so challenging, so you just keep on hating.
You say despising those we have wronged is another way we humans have of dealing with our shame.
I think that's right.
In the debate around the referendum, which we won't dwell on today, but I felt like, because I've read a lot of, obviously, the newspaper articles, as you had, and back then, you know, the terminology was different. It was savages, and there was also, you know, everyone was convinced that we were cannibals, and, you know, that was the sort of language. And this time around, it's been, you know, the, you know... sexual perverts and women bashers and, you know...
But drug addicts and drunks.
Yeah, which equates to the same sort of, denigrate, and they don't deserve this thing because then they're not almost human in a way.
That's there, but what I found even more startling... Firstly, I have to confess, look, I've made one or two mistakes in my life, and one of them was to believe that all the language of... showing off your virtue signalling and all of that kind of thing. I thought it was invented in Republican think tanks in the United States of America in the 1980s, 1990s. It's all there in the newspapers of the 1830s. Mm. Those people who were standing up for the indigenous of this country were mocked as people wanting to show off their humanitarian values, city people who didn't know the reality of life in the bush, people so rich the reality of life didn't touch them and they could therefore voice these kinds of softly, softly opinions. It's all there.
Yes.
And I could listen in the Voice debate to the rhetoric of of William Charles Wentworth's Australian in the 1830s. All the language slightly shifted, but exactly the same intent, which is to mock and humiliate those who are good enough to raise a voice against murder and theft.
And the book is dedicated, a simple dedication, to those who told the truth. Did those people who objected, did they keep you going through the process? What did keep you going? Because I read somewhere else that you said that you kept a promise to yourself. What was the promise you made to yourself? Because I'm not sure.
The promise I made to myself was no excuses. That was the promise I made to myself. And I kept that promise.
So no excuses in terms of what I'm tired, it's too long.
No excuses about my family.
Oh, right.
Okay. No excuses, because as I worked on this and I discovered, I mean, we all have, whether we know it or not, an infinite number of relatives. And I had never really met any of the relatives of the Ewer family who were my, you know, my mother's grandmother's people. I've now met lots of them, and they vary. There are splendid men like John Ewer, who is an academic at ANU, who's a great authority on politics and fiction in the 19th century, terrific work. And there were others who had spent a lot of time constructing bullshit accounts of their ancestors and at times publishing them in places like quite prestigious online forums for talking about the native police and frontier wars. But it's just bullshit. And my view
no
was...
No swearing, David, no swearing.
My view was that I was not going to be a prey to any of that.
Yeah.
That was the no right, excuses.
That was the premise. Okay, well, you stood by it. Sorry, I've got to get a gag in.
I hope I've stood
such
by
a,
it.
It's such a tricky subject, so forgive me for trying to get a few jokes in.
Look, we have to have a few jokes.
We do.
I mean, they're valuable. They keep us going. They're ways of... They're actually little engines of insight.
Well, on that subject, your wit... I mean, I've read a lot of these books that... the history of frontier violence in Australia. I think I've read most of them.
Oh, you poor thing, having to read that.
Well, they're not. Well, this is the thing. There's not that many, right? Ken Burns, the documentary filmmaker, I met him once when he came to Australia, and people would be familiar with his work, The Civil War, and those brilliant documentary series that he makes. Anyway, I was trying to get some advice from him, and he said, well, you know, Rachel, there's 10,000 books written about the Civil War in Australia, in the US. And I was like, 10,000? On a bookshelf in Australia, one shelf, you know, one small shelf.
But some very distinguished work.
A metre and a half long.
But some very distinguished
very
work.
Very distinguished work.
Which
but
we're absolutely indebted to.
Absolutely. And I've interviewed most of those historians and I owe them a great debt because their work has assisted me in telling these stories. But it is thin on the ground. But I think the thing that marks this book. There's many things about the uniqueness of this book and its readability, but your wit comes through constantly.
Does it?
Yes, and very good. He's got this great way of... Because obviously he's quoting a lot of primary sources a lot of the time to, you know, bring these
beautiful
people to life. But then you give these, you know, you have the primary source quote and then there's a line, like a killer line that he comes back in with. So when you get this book, which... I suggest you do because it's going to be remembered as one of the major, more significant works that will contribute to our Australian history. It is really impressive and I've read all of the books there are to read about it and it's a standout.
Thank you.
When you get it, don't worry that it's, you know, going to be... It is a tough subject. It is hard reading. It's confronting. The injustice is very confronting. But actually, the way that you humanise the characters as well. So you don't just say, oh, here's a guy just doing this. You know about his dilemmas and his pride and his vulnerabilities and who his father was and the jostling behind the scenes that got them to that point. So there's all this intrigue and he talks about the squabbles between people and the sort of crazy letter writing. And so it's just rich with detail that make it completely entertaining. as well as deeply unsettling and motivating, I think. That's just my
That's
review.
Very, very, very kind of you.
Well, it's
to
very
say.
True. It really distinguishes it, I think.
But I'm
really
fascinated by character. I'm fascinated by contradiction.
Yes.
There was an old editor working at the National Times when I went to the National Times in the late 1970s, and he said, if you don't grasp the contradiction in people and stories, you're not telling the truth. And contradiction is all through this book.
Yeah.
The mix of appalling and good. And, you know, there is a contradiction I explore, which I have to say, with some pain, has not been taken up sufficiently. And, I mean, maybe Rachel was about to, but I do argue that the theft of Aboriginal women being such a prime cause of violence on the frontier should have led authorities to encourage sodomy amongst the shepherds. Now,
you do mention that in the book.
I do mention it, and I quote some material from the time, and I'm oddly enough, it's not one of the arguments in the book that's been taken up by critics or interviewers.
Brought it up. Anyway. I did circle that section and had a good laugh in it, but I didn't.
There isn't. She's looking at the index.
I'm looking at the index for sodomy.
It can't be there. Please
Let's
tell
check.
Me it's not
Let's
there.
Check if they've done their work properly. South Australia, South Sea Islanders, Somerset, some.
You've already gone too
no,
far.
No, there's no sodomy. Snodgrass is in there though, Colonel Snodgrass.
Oh, Colonel Snodgrass! What a fancy pants.
Anyway, let's talk about. Oh,
and
go,
a
go.
Brutal man. I mean, there's another contradiction.
Yes.
I mean, Snodgrass was the Deputy Governor of New South Wales when Burke finally left, having been betrayed by his masters in London, and he left. He sailed down Sydney Harbour, standing on the deck of the ship with his hat off, acknowledging the hundreds and hundreds of people lining the harbour and hundreds of people in little boats, which, by the way, Richard Jones' newspaper, because he got control of a newspaper in this, described as a felon mob. The minute Burke was out the heads, Snodgrass took over and he would do what Burke refused to do, which was to send military detachments to put down the blacks. Burke would not do that because of his experience in South Africa, then deliciously called the Cape. And don't you still believe... Don't you believe
the
it was
Cape
so,
of Good Hope?
No, just the Cape.
The Cape.
Burke wouldn't do it. Snodgrass did it. And that gives us Wellington Creek a few weeks later, January the 26th, the slaughter at Waterloo Creek. The slaughter at Waterloo Creek, yep.
And really, though, I suppose that's a fundamental... approach to making writing compelling, isn't it? To tell the stories through character?
Yes, and to show the extent to which stories are propelled by character. I've always believed character is a very important element both of history but particularly in my career of politics. I've always been fascinated by the character of the people who are our leaders. And so, yes, I am fascinated by character. But character is not the whole answer, of course, because there's also economics and busts and booms and the way in which the economy played out. Busts, by the way, were a very good time for the Indigenous people because when the squatters were really short of cash, they couldn't afford to hire European shepherds. Mm. So instead of clearing the blacks from their land, they employed them.
Going back to your point about contradiction, which I agree with, having the complexity of contradiction makes for much more interesting writing, storytelling, and it's just the way the world is.
Yes.
Tell us about Frederick Walker, and his great contradiction. Tell us a bit about who he was and this great contradictory thing he had about being in and out, you know.
Frederick Walker was the first commandant of the native police. He came highly recommended to the government by William Charles Wentworth, on whose property he had worked down in the Murrumbidgee. Walker was the most fascinating combination of brutality and good sense. He understood, for instance, that the principal, the stealing of women and children, because the kidnapping of children was also an appalling provocation to violence, but the principal provocation to violence were those squatters who wanted to clear the blacks entirely off their land. Walker understood that this was the dynamite under the frontier. He also understood in a way that European authorities just couldn't get their heads around, that the bush was not free to the Aboriginal people either. They couldn't just leave their land and go on to another nation's land. Because the protocols... And he said to the governor, why don't we have a rule that if the squatters are clearing their land of blacks, we will refuse them the assistance of the native police, either to clear their land or to deal with the violence that that provokes. And it was a very sensible, shrewd idea. And the governor said, no, we can't do that. We can't do that.
So here's an excerpt of, I think it's his one of his arguments that he published in the Sydney Morning Herald.
They all argued their cases, God bless them, in the press.
Yes,
God bless them.
So he says, on that point, he says, so long as settlers carry on the system of preventing the blacks from obtaining their lawful means of livelihood and persist in not showing to them that old grudges and vindictiveness are thrown on one side by the whites, which the blacks will believe, they are allowed at the stations, and not till then, so long will a system of depredations be carried on, which the native police may check but cannot permanently put an end to. So he was saying this is an impossible... And you explained, Walker's argument, laid out in the Sydney Morning Herald and the Moreton Bay Courier, infuriated those squatters determined, in the jargon of the time, to keep the blacks at a distance. That was almost all of them. Few were willing to let the blacks in, which became known and reviled as the Walker policy.
And yet, and this man had genuine affection for the troopers that he recruited down on the Murrumbidgee, where he had once worked, and those men appeared to have affection for him. I was telling Rachel this before, he had an Aboriginal nickname which has always been said to mean big legs, but a wonderful linguist at the ANU sent me this beautifully argued letter to say, really, we think if you take a closer look, it meant big nose. And so the new editions of the book have him as big nose. He did look after his men. He disciplined them, but he looked after them. He wrote of them quite tenderly, but at the same time, he led them into slaughters.
And
contradiction.
Tell us about this great scene that you sort of create when he's, you know, at the end of his time and he's on the island. Can you just tell us this? You draw it beautifully.
The problem with being an officer of the native police is that it takes a certain toll. Slaughtering people month after month takes a toll on the human spirit. And the usual pattern after 5 or 6 years as an officer of the native police was to be a drunk. To be a complete drunk. And that is how Walker ended up. He was also... he was essentially stealing funds. He wasn't accounting for funds, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But he had a golden tongue, and for a long time he could persuade the authorities and wrote beautifully in the Sydney Morning Herald that almost deified him. But eventually he was just so much of a drunk that he was facing the sack. And he tried to get the troopers to leave with him. And he wrote to them, and one of the letters to the troopers survives.
Yes.
And it's almost a love letter to them.
It's beautiful, yes.
Saying, you know, come with me. When I go, come with me. And they didn't. And it broke him. Later he...
Well, two eventually did, didn't they? And then they...
A few came back to him later.
And when he described that series, gets out the sword.
Oh... So all but two, this is in Brisbane near Christmas in 1855, and two of the men decide that they'll stay with him, and then they change their mind, and then they go back to get their gear.
Because he's roaring drunk, isn't he?
And he's roaring drunk, and he makes the mistake of pulling his sword and threatening a government official with his sword, and that was it. He was completely out. Later on, he was employed. He was one of the people who mapped the route for the telegraph line to the Cape and various other things. Mm. And he had a private army which he rented out to squatters to kill blacks as well. But this was a richly puzzling figure. And he's there at the very origins of the native police. And I became, in a very disciplined way, Rachel, fascinated with him.
Yes. But I think it makes it all come alive. I think, you know, you can deal with history and just, you know, Frederick Walker, native police officer, date to date, you know, but it comes alive in character, and that's why such a gifted storyteller as you, I'm just so pleased that you took on this enormous task of writing this. But I'll come to that later, because it takes a talent to be able to portray the complexity of the situation, the epic nature of it, and, you know, in David we have someone up to the task.
But the detail is so wonderful.
It is.
And for historians of this... For historians of this subject, of the violence on the frontier, some of that detail is irrelevant to their work. And
yes.
Sebastian and I went back to the primary sources from which they drew, and you just sit there in wonder that they left that detail out. Yeah. And sometimes it's just a tiny detail, and we discovered this only the other day, and it will go into the new edition of the book, that a police officer sent out to investigate a slaughter on the West Australian goldfields in the middle 1880s was dispatched by camel. And that's just what you need. You just buy camel. And then that whole world comes alive by camel.
Well, you had a very generous editor, clearly, because it's quite a large thing and he let you be 2 years over.
He's had experience of me before. And, of course, he is a very, very, very fine editor.
With a very, very fine publishing arm, Black Ink.
Which is, the you know, one of the very best publishers in Australia. Look,
yes.
He took it on the chin. I'd promised a quick book. So I started work on it the minute George Pell went into prison. I thought, right, that's that one finished. Now we'll get on with the...
Just this other tiny little story.
On with my family's role as slaughterers on the frontier. And then, as I was saying before, I became more and more and more fascinated by the rich background of these events. And so the book grew backwards in a very strange way because there are the slaughters. Moved backwards, and Chris Fike, who's my editor and the editor of other people here at the festival... And they all know and love and respect him and also understand when I would say send the fifth or sixth version of the first paragraph of the book, he would
it's
reply...
It's a very good paragraph. Yeah.
No, he would reply, David, you have disimproved this. But he took it on the chin. But then we were going to... There was no problems at all. We were going to have the book out at least 6 months before the referendum, voice referendum... But Sebastian and I just kept finding more material.
Yes, it's a rabbit hole, isn't it? It's many rabbit holes.
You have to go down a lot of rabbit holes to find a rabbit. Mm-hmm. But when you find the rabbit, you are very reluctant to give it up. And let me tell you, there would have been about 25,000 more words. I mean, words which, if you knew them, you would weep not to be able to read them in the book now. But it was perhaps a little bit irrelevant to go into the entire history of the press in early Sydney. But as a journalist, I became... I mean, the press is as brutal now as it was in 1823.
Yes.
That's another part of it. Control of the press
Control
was as brutal
the
then. And, of course, the hilarious discovery that the best journalists in the colony were all convicts. But so I had to get a bit disciplined around that. And so part of the length of time the book took was finding the courage to chop 40, 50,000 words out of it.
Oh, that's tough.
And it's exhilarating in the end. There's a kind of exhilaration. Oh, yeah, that was a month's work. But it took time
tough.
And I had Chris's backing all the time. And then, you know, I don't like to give away commercial secrets and I don't know why The Voice didn't think of this, but there's one book market... for Father's Day, and there's one book market for Christmas, and the Voice vote fell just after Father's Day, and therefore the book, I think, had to be held for a couple of weeks more to hit the Father's Day market, to the Christmas market. Right, I mean, I'm talking bullshit, of course, because yes, I'm just trying to find excuses
for that line.
How slow... I'm not at all ashamed of how long it took to write, but it did take a long time.
It does take a long time. Yeah. It takes a long time
to do. It takes a long time to make television, too.
Well, yes,
Were the Australian Wars... How long did the Australian Wars, the three-part series shown last year, take?
Thank you for the little plug.
Well, everybody
showing
here has
on
seen
SBS
it.
Right now. Well, it was meant to take 2 years, but it took five.
So why are you quizzing me, madam?
Because to make the point that you can't let go of a story and it needs to be written properly and fully and thoroughly, and if it takes an extra 2 years, that's what it takes, but it has to be done.
Yeah.
So I'm not quizzing you. I'm supporting you.
Thank
you. To make the point that it takes time to write great work, and that's what you've done.
Thank you. Thank you.
So don't feel bad about that at all. So we're going to go to questions in a minute. So I'm going to... This is your... Oh, thank you, Lisa. Alira. So I think you stand next to the microphone over there. You're all veterans at this festival. And we're going to take quite a few if we can cram them in. So please feel welcome to do that. Not long statements, though. I know everyone says, yeah, no, I'm not going to make a statement, but I just want to make this statement about this. So we won't be doing that.
If you promise to be brief, I promise to be brief. Let's have that as a pact between us.
Yes, and we might even go to the first one and I'll come back and we'll have a little chat just before we finish up.
Yeah, let's go back and forth.
Yeah. Sir.
David, I'm about as old as you, but not as wise. I'm ashamed how most Australians voted in the referendum. I think the only solution is to have a republic, and to that end, I nominate Noel Pearson and you to be our first two co-presidents.
Okay.
My question
off topic,
is, will
off
you
accept topic.
It?
That was a statement.
Yep.
So we first had our first fail at not having a statement.
But I'm going to have to reply to it, sir.
Okay. Only
sir,
it's you.
How can you have any hope for a republic when this simple and polite gesture to the Indigenous people of Australia was defeated vehemently by the Conservative parties of Australia? How, sir, can you believe in change in this country when opposing change is the calling card of the opposition? Don't come back to the microphone.
Yes. Banned.
Banned.
Banned. Yes, sir.
David, one of the great revelations of the book for me was the fact that Indigenous people were recruited in one part of the country to be taken to another to slaughter other Indigenous people. That was a shocking revelation. And I imagine, and this is maybe for Rachel as much as for you, how difficult is it for today's Indigenous people to accept that history?
Well, let's start by saying it's bloody difficult for white Australians to accept that history. In the 5 years that I was working on this book, and not only making no secret of what I was doing, but boring my friends to distractions. I talked about this book solidly for 5 years. I work out what I'm thinking by talking. What I was doing was no secret. In the whole of that time, I never heard from or of another descendant of a white officer of the Native Police. Never. So the difficulty of facing this is something shared by black and white Australia.
And so the explanation, the second part of your question, yes, you're right. People were deliberately recruited hundreds of kilometres from their own people because they were therefore going into foreign territory. And, you know, we weren't all roaming around everywhere being friends with each other. There's a lot of animosity between different nations and fear, and you couldn't cross into another person's territory without permission. So these territorial boundaries, very well observed. So for those officers, they were leaving their... those Aboriginal officers leaving their country and going into foreign territory. So it was very deliberate on behalf of the officers to design the force in that way. Do you want to comment on that?
Absolutely. Yeah. And, of course, if you're a man from the Murrumbidgee and you're taken up to work or slaughter on the Darling Downs, you can't go home. You can't go home. Now, later, there was a lot of desertion because squatters really liked to employ former native police troopers because they were disciplined and did good work. And that was a very interesting little political struggle I talk about in the book. But you couldn't go home.
And they were stuck in foreign territory.
They were stuck. And there were pleas at various times, can't you give us horses so we can go home? The answer to that was no. And for those men, the people of the Darling Downs were as foreign as the officers who led them on the killing expeditions on the Darling Downs.
So they'd have to fight their way back.
Yeah.
But yes, there's not, because the records are so scarce of who the Aboriginal officers were, because they're often just known by the first name.
And we don't have, and God knows everybody has searched, we don't have any personal account from any of the over 1,000 troopers who served in the native police of why they served, of why they were recruited, of why they did what they did.
Because there's no, obviously, primary sources recording there. And everybody's searched, as you say. Hope that answers your question. But actually, just on that, Mina Murray, a fantastic historian, Wiradjuri woman, is writing a book on frontier violence, and she has a great quote in your book about victims.
She spoke to me beautifully about the recruitment process, and she said a line that just knocked me out. She said, "Victims don't make good choices."
Yeah, it's...
What a woman. Victims yeah. don't make good choices.
It's a great...
I'm looking forward to her book very, very much.
So am I.
I'm very grateful that she let me quote her in mine.
Rachel, a little nostalgia. I just love that photo of your father by the late, great South Australian photographer...
Robert
McFarlane.
Yes, what a beautiful man he was.
Thanks. Yeah. My question, though, is... having learned a lot about Ray's family from the front cover of the Bulletin, I would like to ask him why Sebastian Tesserero isn't on the front cover of his book, like Sylvia is on the front cover of John Lyon's book.
Yes, I noticed that.
Jerusalem.
Yes, I noticed that.
Well, he is the dedication, though, is there?
Well, he's here. He can come up and answer.
Yes, come up and answer why you're not on the front cover, Sebastian.
No, he's gestured towards me. Look, because the book is mine,
I think he means that not.
I don't mean that in a slighting way at all. But the words are mine. He fashioned them. He tested me. I mean, I will go to the grave remembering one comment he wrote on an early chapter. David, he said, "If you must show your prejudices, is this the place to do it?"
Wow.
He's a very tough and wonderful editor. But in the end, the actual writing was mine, and he was the intellectual scaffold for the book. And I think that's how we divided our responsibilities. I'm hoping that when I research the book on his Sicilian pirate ancestors... a joke he still doesn't find funny.
No, he's not laughing. He's the only one not laughing. He says, "I did not work alone. This book is the result of a deep collaboration over 4 years with my partner, Sebastian Tesserero."
Yeah.
Might not be on the front page, but it's... the dedication is right there.
David, you've written books about Garfield Barwick, Patrick White, etc. Now you've moved into the zone of history, which has not been told before, certainly amongst white community. Why do you think people like Manning Clark, Geoffrey Blaney, other historians have never covered this part of our history before, and you're apparently the first one to do so?
I'm not the first one. Yeah. I am not the first one. I mean, apart from anything, there is Rachel's television series after you, which is astonishingly beautiful.
It was based on a lot of historians' books.
Yes,
but not a huge amount.
But she can do what writers can't. She made the landscape weep in a way that is, you sit there watching it and the landscape is mourning what is being told. It's so extraordinarily beautiful. But I'm not the first. I'm absolutely not the first, and I'm not the last either. And this is just one cut through an enormous history. And, you know, one of the things that I become more and more curious about is this notion that we just forgot about it. That's bullshit. We constructed a fake history for Australia. And it starts with Captain Cook and goes to Gallipoli and does not mention the Aboriginal people.
Yeah.
And that fake history is an astonishing cultural construct, but it is crumbling. It is absolutely crumbling. It's over. Done with. I'm interested that there has not been a whisper from anybody yet. Maybe they're preparing a D-Day landing against the project, but there's not been a whisper from the forces who've previously denied that the frontier was violent.
Well, when you put the evidence out like that, it's very hard to dispute. I mean, Geoffrey Blainey did write a number of books on the Indigenous experience, and I suppose we should, you know, credit Henry Reynolds as one of the first writers who wrote The Other Side of the Frontier. I mean, I don't know whether you've read
and
that
you know,
book,
and Judith Wright.
And Judith Wright, yes.
Judith Wright in the Cry for the Dead.
Yeah.
This territory has been crossed before. I'm not a pioneer of it, but I hope, yes. And I hope that there will be lots more to come. I have heard from so many people come up to me in signing queues and things saying, yes, my great-grandfather was at, naming a remote Queensland spot, and I said, well, do you know about Trove, the mighty engine designed by the National Library which allows Australians free of charge to word search newspapers back to 1788. And if you are at all curious about what your family might have been up to west of Baraba, go to Trove and have a look.
Next.
on the southern side of the Parramatta River, there's a point called Ur's Point. Or
Ur.
But it, is that...
Look, I know the Germans say Ur, but in Australia it became Ur. And by the way, it makes trove searching incredibly difficult. You have no idea how much German language
Before
classified
you...
advertising.
Okay,
was.
This is one of those moments where I'm going to say, let's not go down that rabbit hole.
Yeah, okay, that's okay.
Because yes, well, so he had a part of it.
The question was that I had was when you did that trip to Queensland for the Bulletin, was that when you became interested in racial politics, or given that you had what you might describe as a comfortable upbringing, did it occur earlier than that, or was that the time?
I was interested in that as a... I don't think you had to have a special upbringing or a special insight. It was just blindingly obvious, important issue in Australian politics. Ewer's Point, by the way, is named after an early sheriff of New South Wales who was an uncle of the killers that I write about. Yeah.
Excellent.
And they're very fine people, the descendants of those people. In fact, some of them married into Manning Clark's family. hey, look, Geoffrey Blainey is a great historian. He really is. And apart from anything, he's an invaluable historian when you're talking about the mining districts of Queensland, where the Ewers were also very active. And he calls my great-great-grandfather... I think he calls him a prophet of the field or something. So, you know.
Yeah. Next.
Thank you very much for your presentation. And also thank you for mentioning Trove, which itself was under attack a couple of years ago in terms of its funding. But I want to ask you about the importance of primary sources in state and public archives, and whether you feel that the maintenance and development of archival resources in this country is central to the telling of the stories.
Yes, of course it is. But one of the great things is that those records are being digitised. And this book is another product of COVID. And when all of the archives and libraries shut down, we were still able to work because of Sebastian's ingenuity as a searcher online. And the more that material becomes digitised, the more access people will have, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And yes, archives are crucial to our understanding of who we are as a nation, and they must never, never go short of funds.
But in South Australia, I've got a friend, Jonathan Richards, who's doing some work with me on the Northern Territory, and, of course, all the archives are down here. They're only open...
And he was a great help to me as
well. 3 days a week because they don't have enough money to stay open. 3 days a week.
The National Library in Canberra, you can't... In the National Library in Canberra, you can't order a book at the weekend. You've got to order it earlier in the week. I mean, this is just ridiculous.
The archives need support. Next.
I've slightly touched on this, but my question's about truth-telling from non-Indigenous people. Often we talk about the Uluru Statement from the heart and we talk about truth-telling. People were thinking about Aboriginal people having an opportunity to tell their stories. And I'm just thinking, given what you say about your book and what Kate Grenville has said about all the source material she came across when writing Secret River, whether you think there might be now a big surge in truth-telling by non-Indigenous people, and a lot of us don't have the skills that you have to research and write, but if people were wanting to do that, do you have ideas on how we might build a more, build some non-Indigenous truth-telling in this country?
There are websites everywhere only too anxious to receive the results of people whose individual research on Trove and in other ways reveals our past. Don't for a moment underestimate the appetite for those discoveries. And please, my advice is just do it.
And a lot of the historians that I work with start as amateur historians. They're just doing something for a project and then they uncover this stuff. Then it leads to another thing and then they find a subject. And those regional, local histories are so important because then people like David and I can... You know, it takes those regional localised histories to patch together the huge thing. So it's very important to work on your own histories and your areas.
Regional historical societies are fabulous.
Now we're running out of time, so.
Oh, we've got 2 minutes, and
I want to say so. I found the sodomy bit too.
Oh.
See, it's just a good gags in there. No, anyway.
She was not paying any attention to what I was saying.
Okay.
She was inflamed by the pursuit of sodomy.
I won't be the first or the last.
All right.
Okay. Yes.
Hello, David. As you have so much to say that this country needs to hear, those 40 or 50,000 words that were edited out of the book, can we expect a volume two?
No. Sebastian and I continue to work. I've just had the extraordinary experience of reading the book for an audio book, and as a result I've made a few more changes, and they'll be there in the electronic versions of the book and in the next printing, and my editor, Chris Fike, is lining up psychiatric care for me.
OK, I want to just deliver you one of these lines that I talked about. So it's this... Threlkeld, who was a missionary, who was one of those great voices of truth, wasn't he?
A great voice of truth. A missionary who had wonderful contacts with the Aboriginal people of the Hunter Valley. He would hear rumours and he then went and investigated them himself and then informed the authorities. As a result, a white officer was charged with murder. He got off, but he was charged.
And he was run out of town and tortured and harassed and dismissed and still is. Actually, today.
That's what?
Threlkeld.
Really?
Yes.
Isn't it?
So he says, I have heard at night shrieks of girls about 8 or 9 years of age taken by force by the vile men of Newcastle. One man came to me with his head broken by the butt end of a musket because he would not give up his wife. There are now two government stockmen that are every night annoying the blacks by taking their little girls. My wonder is... that more whites are not speared than are considering the gross provocation given. And then you said, and here's the one-liner, which is sort of funny but totally devastating, more sodomy might have meant for a quieter frontier, when he's talking about the abuse of Aboriginal women and girls on the frontier, which
was... It was a bleak joke, ladies and gentlemen.
No, but it was a trigger joke. You know, it was this trigger for war. We forget the role of women on the frontier and how it was just heartbreaking. And my own great-grandmother, who, of course, was raped after she survived a massacre, was chained to a tree, and that's how we survived, because she was a young woman on the frontier. So these things that, you know, seem out of reach, oh, that was such a long time ago, but they're in our families and the history needs to be dealt with. And can I say that one of the reasons I'm here is to sit on the stage and honour the work that David and Sebastian have done and the publisher has done to bring this work to the public. It is a fantastic contribution. We owe you a great debt. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. And that's the end. Sorry.